Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we bring you on a unique journey into the private life of a family of badgers.
The badger, more than any other of our native animals, has a very, very good sense of smell. Okay. It doesn't have great eyesight like a fox. It has a great sense of smell. And if it gets a scent of man, it won't come out of its burrow. It'll go back down.
In his latest On the Shoulders of Giants miniseries, Terry Flanagan discovers the great yellow bumblebee. And on the 40th anniversary of the movie Tarka the Otter, we hear about an otter survey in Galway City.
Henry Williamson's world-famous novel, Tarka the Otter, is a hauntingly beautiful, sometimes savage story about the joyful water life of an otter, one of the most secretive yet lovable of God's creatures.
As always, we've got a very busy program ahead of us today. I don't know how I'm going to fit it all in, but I'm going to do my best. So, sit back and enjoy the ride. We start with one of the most incredible, extraordinary creatures on this planet, the beaver.
A beaver, one of the family that lives here in this lake at the foot of the Teton Mountains in Wyoming. And they're accomplished engineers. This great pond is entirely their own creation. Only a few years ago, this shallow, pebbly stream flowed straight down the valley. Then a family of beavers moved in and built a dam. The main body of it is built of boulders. On the downstream side, it's been lined with logs, some of them big and quite heavy, and on this side, it's been packed with mud and vegetation. It's been built so accurately that it is to within a few inches horizontal across its entire length of about 150 yards from one side to the other. And the lake it's created stretches upstream for almost a mile.
David Attenborough there from the BBC's 2002 series Life of Mammals, reminding us what an industrious lot beavers are and what extraordinary dam-building skills they have. Although there's no evidence that we've ever had beavers here in Ireland, even today we still invoke their spirits in everyday parlance when we talk about beavering away or being as busy as a beaver. Over the centuries, beaver populations have been decimated after being trapped for their glands for medicine and musk and their pelts for clothing. And here we do have a connection to beavers because as a native of Donnybrook here in Dublin, I'm very familiar with one of our local streets, Beaver Row. And the story of the Beaver Hat Factory, which was set up by the Wright brothers in 1813. The factory has long since closed, along with the Wesleyan Methodist Church and school, which had been built to service the needs of the workers, many of whom were thought to have come over from Yorkshire in the United Kingdom. But I digress. The Eurasian beaver, or European beaver, is a species that was once widespread in Eurasia, but as mentioned earlier, it was hunted to near extinction for its fur. By the early 1900s, about 1,200 beavers survived in 8 populations in Europe and Asia. But since then, reintroduction programs have seen a revival in numbers. In 2009, they were reintroduced into Scotland, and this year, they were granted protected status. Jack van der Noot is a wildlife ranger with the State Forest Service in the Netherlands. He was part of the team of scientists responsible for reintroducing beavers to that country 30 years ago. Recently, I paid a visit to the Beesbos National Park, one of the largest national parks in the Netherlands and one of the best extensive areas of freshwater tidal wetlands in northwestern Europe. No better place to reintroduce beavers. And there I met with Jack van der Noot.
I am Jacques van der Noot, G-A-C-Q-U-E-S, van, V-A-N, D-E-R, Noot, N-E-U-T.
Correct.
That's right.
You passed the first test.
Yes, right, okay.
So tell me what you do here.
My profession is a ranger for the State Forest Service. And I'm working in the Beesbos National Park for 43 years now.
The perfect habitat for biodiversity, is it not? It's full of all sorts of wonderful creatures, big and small.
Yeah, that's right. Especially the birds attract the attention, of course, especially in wintertime. We get a lot of geese and waterfowl from northern parts of from Europe. A lot of pintails and shovelers, you know, and shell ducks. And, of course, we have birds of prey as well. And since the last years, we even have breeding white-tailed eagle and breeding osprey. And that's really bullseye.
Okay, but they're not necessarily going to stay here, or will they, do you think?
Well, they breed. So
I know they breed, but do you think they'll stay?
Yeah.
Always a big debate about whether or not you should reintroduce species if you're going to go that way. And that's why I'm here today, because I'm from an area called Donnybrook, which is in Dublin, a suburb of Dublin. And actually, Donnybrook is a word in the English language. There was a famous fair which took place there every year, and there was always trouble at the fair. So a Donnybrook is a riot.
Okay.
And I've only ever heard the word used once in my entire life outside of where I'm from, and that was in a movie called The Quiet Man, starring John Wayne and Barry Fitzgerald and Maureen O'Hara. But there's one scene where Maureen O'Hara and John Wayne are walking down a small country boreen, a small road, and Barry Fitzgerald is a matchmaker, and they're having a row, and he says, is this a Corton or a Donnybrook?
Nice day.
It is that, Mr. Taunton.
That's a pretty bonnet you have on.
Bonnet? Don't you be talking to me about bonnets. After leaving mine stuck up there like a...
Easy now, easy now. Is this a Corton or a Donnybrook? Have the good manners not to hit the man until he's your husband and until he hit you back.
And that's the only time I've ever in my entire life in a movie heard reference to Donnybrook. Another time was in New York when a guy was giving us a tour of the River Hudson and he mentioned the word Donnybrook. I couldn't believe it. But at any rate, the reason I mentioned Donnybrook and why I'm from there is because there is a road in Donnybrook called Beaver Row.
I see.
And it turns out that back in the day, there was a beaver hat factory there. They were making hats from beaver fur. Yeah. But we never had beavers in Ireland.
Okay, I see.
Now, you had beavers here in the Netherlands.
Yeah, that's right.
150 years ago, there were beavers everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. And we made hats also. It was a very special kind of hat because the pelt, the fur from a beaver is exceptionally good. So that's why they were more or less harvested. Mm-hmm. And we killed the last one in 1826 in a small village called Zalk. And it's near the vicinity of the river, the IJssel, in the Netherlands. From that period on, we had no beavers anymore. In fact, they were extinct. So after extinction, there came some ideas, you know, for reintroducing beavers again. And that was in the 50s from the last century. And since then, up till 1988, the wonder became reality.
Why did it take so long?
Well, there were some arguments about other people. And other people are, of course, farmers who were afraid of a lot of damage, you know, with beavers, and especially the making holes in dikes and making long tunnels in dikes, and also the building of dams where the crops are being inundated. So that were really concerned in these days.
So there was a consultation process that went on with the locals to tell them that the beaver isn't going to do this? I mean, could you be sure the beaver wouldn't do that and it wouldn't cause these problems?
No, we didn't know, because for us it was brand new. The whole world changed since 1826 because it's now densely populated, you know, and everywhere there are roads and there's traffic. So there was a really big concern, but the reason the beaver disappeared was hunting. Mm. And not loss of habitat. We have the habitat, we have the beesbos, and they're still being reintroduced now since 1988. And now we have a few hundreds of beavers. A few hundreds, I think, 350. And some, at least 120 beaver lodges. So I think the reintroduction program was very successful.
Good. Yes. Well, how did you get involved in it?
Well, I'm a ranger for the State Forest Service. And since the coming up from those ideas and those questions and wishes, I went up to Eastern Germany in 1988 to collect the first one. So we were... In fact, we are the manager of the Biesbosch National Park, so we were responsible for bringing the beaver back. But we couldn't do that without any permission from the people from the agricultural world, agriculture ministry, you know. Yeah. So afterwards, we get permission, and the first came in 1988. We collected the beavers from Eastern Germany because the samples from DNA are more or less the same with the DNA from the beavers that we had before.
But 1988? Taking Beavers. This was before the wall came down. Yeah. And I remember watching on TV, as a lot of people my age will, the Berlin Wall, 1989.
I know.
Being chipped away.
And it was quite an astonishing trip, you know, because we had to cross the borderline and people with tall hats and everywhere were searchlights and machine guns and barbed wire. It was totally another type of world. So that was quite an amazing story. But we survived and we got back in 1989. In total, we reintroduced 42 beavers from 1988 to 1991.
They must have been very surprised to discover you were taking across beavers across the border as opposed to taking
that's right,
people.
That's right.
Extraordinary times indeed, yeah.
So really tense times, but it was nice to be here after all and to experience the whole story from planning to the reality. You know?
So you bring the beavers back here to Beesbos.
Yes, yes,
well,
yes.
What do you do? I mean, do you just release them into the wild and say, well, hopefully now everything will work? What did you have to do? No,
there was enormous political pressure, you know. In 1988, the first one were released by Gerrit Braks. He was the Minister for Agricultural Affairs. Afterwards, in 1989, we got Prince Bernhard. And he was the husband of the Queen. Yeah, that's right.
But she abdicated in favor of her son.
Yes, yes, that's right. But he was also a kind of chairman with WWF. And when he came, it was not normal anymore because we got so many permits from journalists, you know, who wanted to do their stories and photographers. And
of course, I think the ascension came with it. Once you had the royal seal of approval, so to speak, everybody was interested.
Right. That's right.
But what did you do, though? What did you do? How did you change the habitat here, or did you? What did you do?
Preparation of the reintroduction program. We, first of all, did our orders by that company in Eastern Germany for this year. We would like to have 10 or 12 or 13.
Yeah.
Then the people went them to catch them.
Yeah. In different parts of East Germany.
Yes, that's right.
Not
that's
all from one place.
No.
You're taking brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers.
It's near the river of the Elbe.
Yeah.
River, big river in Eastern Europe. After that, they were collected and they were brought back to the Netherlands in a special constructed wooden box. And the inside of it was prepared with steel, you know. Otherwise, the beef's going to
gnawing their way through.
Freedom, you know. So, and that we want to prevent it. So it was a really nice time to enjoy, you know, and really nice time to experience it. And we never had seen beaver dams before from 100 meters long, you know, and that we could see and observe Eastern Germany. So
you can understand why the local population would be a little bit concerned about you reintroducing them here.
Sure.
If they were going to build dams and raise the water levels, then the surrounding fields are going to be inundated, you're going to have real problems.
That's right. And it was a new species for the Netherlands.
Well,
it was
an old species.
It was here.
That's right.
But then we go back in time, and there you get a lot of opponents, you know, from who have another opinion. That's no problem, but we took quite some time to
I understand.
Talk.
Did you just release them here then?
No, we bought one section in 1988, for instance, or 1989. We separated two beavers for the official moment, you know, with Prince Bernhard.
Official release.
Yes, and the other ones, we just did it very quietly, you know. We went to our boats and we brought the beavers in and we just released them.
But you did nothing else. You just put them into the habitat here and you let nature take its course.
The first reintroduction, we dug the hole in the bank just to give the beaver the relief of, I'm in a den. I'm in a lodge. And the front of the lodge was being protected by all kinds of branches, you know. Mm-hmm. But the beavers just ate them and they ate themselves out to freedom. So that was the beginning. Since then, we didn't do anything. We brought the beavers in and we selected two of them. We kept them apart. We kept them separate for official moments. And that's the story.
So how many have you brought in total?
In total, we brought in 41 animals from over the period from 1988 until 1991. Now, more or less, we estimate the total number of 350 animals divided among at least 120 lodges. So I think the future for beavers in the Beesbos looks very green.
And have there been any problems?
Well, of course, there were. In the beginning, there were a lot of problems with people from the agricultural business. They were afraid for grazing and graving into dikes, you know, and that they built big holes and big tunnels and inundation of crops, and so there were problems enough. But it took quite some time, and we took the patience, you know, and talked with all kinds of people, taking them out, negotiate with people from the agricultural businesses. So, yeah, it was quite...
Money change hands? Did people have to be paid off?
Yeah, that's right. In some cases, when there was damage, we paid it.
Yeah.
Just to get rid of it and no harm done, no complaining, we pay it. But suppose they're here now for 31 years, since 1988 until now, and I think we have paid to beaver damage in the Biesbos, I think some 1,000 guilders.
Okay.
So we are talking about...
Here's a term I haven't heard for a long time.
We are talking about some 500 euros.
Okay.
In 31 years.
Either they did very little damage or you got very reasonable farmers.
I see. I think very reasonable farmers or so. But when there was damage...
The beavers didn't do too much damage anyway.
No. When there was damage, there was a complaint, or a claim, and we paid it.
So how has the landscape changed here, or has it?
On a local scale, there are fantastic examples of how a beaver couple can change their surroundings by means of... Gnawing trees. They collect the branches for building their lodges, and now they have even penetrated dikes because of their gravings. With us, it's absolutely no problem because there are no farmers here.
No. This is a nature reserve.
Yeah.
A national park, actually.
Yes.
Are you described as a national park?
Yeah, that's right.
You want it to be wild and you want it to be what it is and that the animals that live here and the impact they have on it is all natural.
Yeah, that's right.
I have to say, it's a beautiful facility. It really is.
Yeah,
and obviously a lot of people are coming. You can hear the children in the background behind me and the cockerel there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people are coming here now. Are they coming to see the beavers or just enjoy the water or what?
No, and they enjoy the landscape, of course, and some of them are very interested in trying to take a look, a glimpse of beavers. So when electric boats, we are going out in dusk and until 9:30, in the evening, we are trying, especially in the summer months, then we're trying to get a glimpse of swimming beavers. And normally, we see some 4 or 5 beavers. I think only, and I do this quite some years now, and I think only 2 or 3 times that we haven't seen any of them. Only the traces,
Do you get your money back?
Yeah, that, right. No
That's
problem.
What they do in,
sure.
in Dingle and County Kerry to go out and see Fungi the dolphin.
Oh, okay, if you don't see the dolphin, you get
your money back.
Okay.
It's been a success.
Yes. And furthermore, we are changing the Biesbos now. It's expanding because of external problems with high water level protection. So we are changing arable land now into wetland. And that's quite an astonishing thing to experience because you're changing arable lands, with sugar beets and potatoes, now into wetlands with shallow water levels and dragonflies and great white egrets, and bitterns as well. So that's quite something.
So the beaver has restored the ecosystem. It's good for biodiversity.
That's right. And for people who are coming, to enjoy them.
Jacques van der Noot. Now we turn from beavers to badgers. Although widely spread across our countryside, the badger is rarely encountered in the wild. These secretive mammals spend much of their lives in underground sets, coming out at night in search of food. Unlike their otter, stoat and pine marten cousins, they are highly sociable and live together in clans of up to 10 or more. They're incredibly clean and regularly change the bedding in their underground sleeping chambers, even bringing bedding to the surface to air. They do not soil the insides of their sets and use communal shallow pits placed away from their subterranean homes as toilets. Author and naturalist Declan Murphy has set up cameras to closely observe the private lives of these fascinating animals at a set in County Wicklow. Wildlife enthusiast Tara Adcock met with Declan to find out more.
Thanks a million, Derek. So I'm up here in the Wicklow Hills. We won't give away the exact location of the set just in order to protect it. But what I can say is that we're in this beautiful deciduous woodland with the person we're come here to meet, Declan Murphy, actually sitting up in a tree. Declan, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning, Tara. Well, there's not much room up this tree for you to join me, so I'm going to come down and join you.
Don't think I've ever seen a naturalist up a tree before.
Well, being up a tree is a very common place to find a naturalist, because as a naturalist, I've spent my life watching a whole range of birds and animals. And depending on which animal you're watching, that means you have to go to different places. And the animal we're here to talk about today is the badger. And one of the things about badgers is if you want to see them, you've got to climb a tree, even though they live underground. And the reason for that is the badger, more than any other of our native animals, has a very, very good sense of smell.
Okay.
It doesn't have great eyesight like a fox. It has a great sense of smell. And if it gets a scent of man, it won't come out of its burrow. It'll go back down. So the reason we're up on the tree in this viewing platform that I've built is that we're actually over the set and we're looking down on it, so the scent from me carries over the set and doesn't disturb the badgers when they come out.
Isn't that very clever?
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
And if you'd like to come on over here, we can go and have a look at the set itself and we can talk to you through why it's a set and all the interesting features about it.
Sounds great. Let's do that.
So here we are actually at the set. And as you can see, the land around us looks like a bulldozer has gone over it rather than being a natural habitat. There's churned up soil, grass, the whole place looks like it's a mess, doesn't it?
It really does, yeah. We're standing on top of this. It's a soil heap, isn't that what it's called, that we're standing on? It's where the badgers have been taking the dirt out of their sets.
That's right. If you look behind us, there's several holes, and these are some of the entrance holes. Now, the whole area is covered in about 10, 15, maybe more entrance holes because all the set is interlinked.
Wow, that's huge.
And it's huge.
It is.
And they're bringing this soil out here and they're just dumping it. And this is one of the first features you'll notice about a burrow. If you find a rabbit burrow or a fox burrow and you're wondering, what is it? There's very little spoil heaps outside it. And that will tell you it's not a badger. Whereas this one, as you can see, the ground below us that falls away from the set is about 15, 20 feet away. So this spoil heap's about 15, 20 feet high. And this is just one spoil heap outside one set entrance. And there's another one down there and another one over there behind you. And there's several more up here.
How old do you reckon this set actually is?
Well, the spoil heaps always give a good indication as to the age of the set. The size of this tells us that this is a very old set. And it's certainly been here, talking to some people, 40, 45 years, and it was as big as this back then. I think we're looking at 100 years plus for this set.
Really?
Yes.
So this is
one of the biggest. It is. There's several generations have been here.
Good.
But what we don't know is there badgers sleeping beneath us?
Okay.
And that's where being a naturalist and having fieldcraft comes in, because you have to work out, is there badgers here? And let's have a look at this set and see, are there definitely badgers here? Because there's plenty of signs if you know what to look for. The first thing we're going to look at is the entrance itself. There's no cobwebs across it. There's no dirt on the tracks going in. That's because when they're coming out, they're trampling down the soil. There's no debris or anything there. So we can see all these clear trails all going through the woodland.
Okay.
Now, other ways we can find out whether or not the set is active is, first of all, looking for claw marks, scratch marks on the actual trees around us. They're a little bit further away, just down behind the bramble bushes over there. You'll often find bits of hair stuck on twigs and brambles around the place.
Okay.
That's often a giveaway.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, they have a very strong musky scent.
Right.
Exactly. And they have a very strong gland that gives off this scent, especially the dominant boar.
Okay.
So if you go up to the actual net, up to the set entrance and stick your head down, you should be able to have a scent and have a smell here, because this is one of the most active entrance holes. And if we get down and stick our head right down into the burrow, you'll get a big, strong...
Oh, you can definitely smell that. Yeah,
it just kind of comes up. And trying to get that scent of the badgers isn't the only reason that you stick your head down a burrow.
Why? What other reason would you have?
If I was here by myself and there was no sound of human voices talking, the badgers wouldn't be disturbed by my presence just here. And if you stick your head right down, you can actually hear them snoring.
No way!
Yeah, it's quite an amazing sound. If you creep up, you can actually hear, if there's one or two down there, you'll hear rustling as they turn around.
Yeah,
a bit like a dog sitting in his bed. And they're rustling and rolling around, and you will actually hear them snoring. I've heard it a good few times.
That's
and
it's amazing.
It is an amazing sound to hear it coming up from several metres underground. And if you look here in front of us, do you see all this hay that's come out? All this grass and hay all sitting here. That's from the badgers.
Oh, okay.
They bring their bedding out to air it, like you wash the sheets.
Really?
Yes,
no
and they
way.
Go off and they get more. Now, this time of year, they're getting ready for the winter. The bedding is used as insulation on the cold nights.
Wow.
So they're going out into the surrounding fields, getting grass, bracken, hay, and they bring it back. And the way they bring it back is they use their front paws and bring their snout down around it right. rodent a ball, and they shuffle backwards all the way from the fields right up here, up this slope where we're on, and backwards down the...
Have you actually gotten to see this happening?
Yes, we've seen them doing that.
That and must it's be just the cutest thing ever.
It is quite amazing. Yeah. And then they go down, and then they will bring the others back up. The old bedding. And,
okay.
and that's why outside the sets, you'll see all these piles of straw and that. And that's a clear indication that this set is in use. Badgers live in their underground all year round through the winter
so
and the whole time.
They have to keep it clean to keep down the parasites and
yes.
stuff like that. Is that why they excavate more chambers as well as the kind of set gets older? Is that to prevent parasite buildup as well?
I think it's probably more due to the numbers that are
okay.
actually building up, because a set like this could have, for all we know, it's very hard to calculate, but there could be 20, 25 badgers under your feet. If you've met badgers, haven't you? You've seen badgers out and about.
Unfortunately, unlike yourself, I've never seen a badger like firsthand in the field, but what I have seen is when I was monitoring fallow deer with trail cameras, I did kind of, by happy coincidence, have the camera trap set up near a set, and I got to see the cubs playing together. It was just such a beautiful kind of opportunity to see an animal that you generally just don't get to see in the wild, and just behaving naturally, and kind of they were nearly like children playing together. It was kind of a bridging between two species. I felt like I recognised myself in their play behaviour, and I recognise the human species in the play behaviour, which maybe sounds, it's anthropomorphising, but I think it's good to have that connection with nature as well. So Declan, this is obviously something that you observed in much more detail than I have. Can you tell us a bit about a badger year? What does it entail?
I'm delighted that you got so much enjoyment out of seeing those cubs, and I can tell if you were watching the cubs what month of the year you were obviously there, and it was obviously, I'd say, May or June, because that's when the cubs come out. And the whole year of the badger starts back in January.
Okay.
And that's when the badgers are least active, because it's cold.
Mm-hmm.
And then the badgers are born in February. Now, badgers have a very strange breeding strategy called
okay.
delayed implantation.
Is this where the eggs, maybe they can mate in the summer or spring, but the eggs take a while to implant?
That's exactly it. And it confused an awful lot of naturalists in the early years, because they would watch badgers mating in February
okay.
and in March and in April, May, June, and the young always arrived in January. So they couldn't work out how long it took. And what happens is, it's a strategy of the badger
okay.
that it provides the optimum amount of time for mating to take place, because the mating can take place at any time through the year. The fertilised eggs then aren't implanted until December, and then they undergo very rapid growth, and in a very short space of time the young badgers are born in February, and that's the start of the whole year. And the badgers are born blind, they're born naked, and they're tiny, but they grow really fast. Yes, and they grow really fast, and by the time we get through into May, the cubs are coming out from underneath. Now, there can be anything between 1 and 4, but 2 is usually what we have here in Ireland.
Okay.
And they come out and they play all through the summer evenings. And because they're totally nocturnal, the badger year follows the time of sunset. They usually come out shortly after sunset. So in the winter months, if they're coming out, they're coming out at 5 in the evening. In June and July, they're coming out at 11 o'clock. So
hey.
You're really kind of, you're going out at all times of the day and night. And then they carry on with their behaviour through the whole year. There's the feeding changes, and then they start bringing the bad bedding in and out in the autumn. And then, you know, they get ready to spend the winter deep underground.
Okay, so do badgers hibernate then, or are they just a little bit less active during the winter months?
They're definitely less active, and I suppose we have to think about what we mean by hibernate. And if we think of an animal curled up unconscious for 3 months of the year fast asleep, no, they don't hibernate.
Okay.
But they do, depending on the altitude of the set, they do go into a torpor for maybe a couple of days, maybe during extreme weather. And during the middle of the winter when it's snowy, they probably don't come out enough. They can't feed, they can't do anything like
okay.
that. So they would sit out the bad weather. But they are active all year round, just less so in December and January.
So Declan, you said that badgers are very sociable.
You very rarely come across just one badger naturally in its set. There's always groups, and we said the groups could be 20 or 30. It's all to do with their diet.
Okay.
Or certainly related to the diet. Their primary part of their diet is earthworms.
Okay.
Which takes a lot of hunting.
A lot, I'd say.
And you don't get earthworms in every type of habitat. The number of earthworms per square metre in this woodland is far less than the field on the outside.
Okay.
So the territories are very big.
Yes.
And if there was just one badger trying to defend a territory big enough to find all the earthworms it needs all year. He would spend nearly all his time trying to walk around, defend the territory, and wouldn't have the time to feed.
He'd be a very skinny badger, he essentially.
But when there's so many badgers, they can all defend different parts of the territory and protect a much larger territory.
So
and
it's that's a strength in numbers type of scenario.
And that's like earthworms make up well over half their diet.
Right.
And they eat quite a number of different things. They eat hedgehogs, they eat rabbits, and they eat earthworms. And they're quite amazing. I've watched them eating earthworms on moonlit nights.
Okay.
And they swallow them whole.
Okay.
They basically eat them like they're having a bowl of spaghetti.
Really? Like and Lady and the Tramp nearly without Tramp.
Exactly. They just go on and they go and they just hoover them up and swallow them straight down. And they get 200 or 300 worms a night.
Right.
And you can actually hear them slurping.
Seriously. So we've snoring badgers, we've slurping badgers, but you also said that they hunt hedgehogs and rabbits. How on earth does a badger catch a rabbit?
They certainly don't run across the fields and catch them. The rabbits they usually feed on are the young rabbits that are in the little burrow that's blocked up by the female rabbit.
Okay.
And they take them out. And you can always tell when you find a rabbit carcass that it was a badger that killed it.
How?
Because they turn it inside out. They open it up and they eat it and turn the skin inside out.
Right.
And they also do that with hedgehogs because they're one of the few animals that can actually kill and eat a hedgehog.
Yeah, I was going to say, hedgehogs are pretty spiny. It must be a pretty special animal that can get through a hedgehog or eat a hedgehog.
It's all to do with those big sharp claws.
Okay.
They find the hedgehog, they roll him onto his back, they put the two paws in the middle and they press them apart and they eat him out. And all that's left is the inside turned out skin of the hedgehog with all the prickles on it.
Right.
Looks a bit like a horse chestnut nutcase.
Right, okay. Gruesome but effective, essentially.
Very effective.
So there we have our dead hedgehogs, but what about dead badgers? I've heard that there's badger funerals. Is that an old wives' tale or is there some truth to that? What is a badger funeral, Declan?
There's always been these stories about badgers carrying out the dead other members of their clan, burying them, and people have reported seeing this. But a lot of it probably is just coincidence that there has been a badger standing beside a badger on a dead badger on the road. But there was one case back in 1942, and it really beggars belief what the naturalist saw. And there's no question he's giving a true, accurate account. But he saw a female badger come out of a burrow, and she gave a long wail.
Okay.
And a smaller badger came and joined her. And the two of them went down a burrow, and they came back up dragging the old boar, the male, the dominant boar, up out, took him down the set, lay him on the ground, excavated around him, and did actually bury him. And he went down and he pushed the soil aside, and he did find the badger had actually been buried. And it raises two questions. One, how did the female badger tell the young badger what was required? She let out a very distinctive wail, apparently, and it came running. How did it know? And what exactly were they doing? What did they really do when they buried it? That's the only well-documented case. It was made by a very well-known naturalist back in the 40s, and there's no reason to doubt it, although I don't think anybody can really offer an explanation as to why they did it.
So, Declan, coming on to a slightly more delicate question, just around TB. Badgers, there is thought to be a link between bovine tuberculosis in badgers and cattle. Do you have any kind of ideas around this, or what do you think is the link between the two species?
Yes, you're right. It is a very controversial topic, and badgers are always part of the TB story. They actually do have TB and can carry it. Bovine TB was spread to them by the cattle.
Okay.
It's also spread to a number of other animals. And it can be spread on various ways by people's boots, by deer, by a whole range of things. There's a lot of research being carried out on it, and I think there'll need to be an awful lot more research before we come up with a strategy to deal with this, both for the badger's sake and for the farming community.
Thanks so much for having us down, Declan. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you very much, Tara.
It's 40 years since Henry Williamson's novel Tarka the Otter was adapted into a film. The author rejected two offers from Walt Disney and went instead with the noted English wildlife documentary filmmaker David Cobham. It tells the story of an otter living in the North Devon English countryside, charting its life through youth, maturity, and the frequent hostile encounters with its arch enemy, the local hunt. The film is beautiful and moving, and the otters themselves turn out to be natural stars.
Williamson's writing is characterized by a lack of sentimentality about the animals it describes, and the film inevitably features some distressing scenes. The book, Tarka the Otter, has never been out of print since first publication in 1928, and the movie, which was narrated by Peter Ustinov, was voted the 98th greatest family film in a Channel 4 poll. So it must be good.
Henry Williamson's world-famous novel, Tarka the Otter, is a hauntingly beautiful, sometimes savage story about the joyful water life of an otter, one of the most secretive yet lovable of God's creatures. Now, this true-to-life adventure comes to the screen with a cast of irrepressible wild beings and some human beings, too. The camera's eye puts you right into the intimate world of Tarka and his friends, which is full of surprises. Because unlike tame human actors, they stubbornly refuse to follow scripts. Tarka the Otter, a unique experience that will delight the entire family.
At the time the book was published, otters were generally regarded as vermin, but Tarka is credited with transforming public attitude to otters. The Irish Wildlife Trust have been conducting a survey on otters within the city limits of Galway. Over the course of 2 years, a number of volunteers with the group have gone out every weekend searching for otter sprains, or otter droppings if you prefer, along the city's waterways. They've also recruited members of the public to participate and raise awareness of the natural environment that exists within the city. Wildlife cameraman Donald Glacken joined them for Mooney Goes Wild.
We're just on the River Carb, along the Long Walk.
My name is Donald Glacken, and that was my former housemate and good friend, Lenny Antonelli. Lenny and a number of volunteers with the Galway branch of the Irish Wildlife Trust have found a rather unusual activity to occupy their weekends with.
Just going down along the Long Walk to check out a set of steps on the quay, which has always been a good spot for finding otter sprint. And look out, there's one there, right already.
It looks pretty fresh as well.
Yeah, and if you kind of, like if you look in it, you can usually see tiny bones and bits of shells from, I guess, different kinds of crustaceans and shellfish that they'd be eating.
Those of us in the Galway branch of the Irish Wildlife Trust, you know, we're starting to hear more reports of otters in the city. At the time, we also went down to Waterford to do an otter survey training course, and off the back of that we decided that it would be a good idea to do an otter survey of otters in Galway City to get a sense of where they were occurring in Galway City and how widespread they were. There was kind of a citizen science element to the project in that we wanted, number one, for the survey to kind of make some noise about it and make the public aware that it was going on and make them aware that there are otters in the city, and also to get people who are interested in wildlife and nature involved and give them a couple of practical skills for finding signs of otter activity, for identifying otter sprint, for doing some survey work, and to get involved in kind of studying wildlife in their area.
They're fairly regular when they do. It's like they're annoyed that we're removing it, so they come back and like do it in the same spot.
Grace Kilbane was originally a volunteer with the Otter Survey, but has since gone on to take a more active role with the Galway branch of the Irish Wildlife Trust.
Before, when I started, I wasn't a member of IWT, and now I'm on the committee 2 years now, just through doing that, because I found it so interesting and I wanted to get involved more and try and make more people aware of what's sort of on their front doorstep, I suppose.
Could you pass me a tube there, Grace?
Sure. Here you go. And they are being very territorial, and they're in like a fast flowing river and things, they'll actually poo like under stones so that it doesn't wash away. So like when people are out looking for them, like you have to know the area that you're in, so like people will look under stones and things to try and get it, because they are trying to mark it. Yeah.
Were you surprised by how much sprints you found, or how much activity you encountered?
Yes and no. At first,
At first, when we didn't really know where to look, we were doing lots of surveys and not finding anything, and people were coming along, and I think maybe being a bit frustrated that we'd spent, you know, an hour and a half walking along looking at nothing. But after a while, we started to kind of figure out the kind of sites that otters were more likely to use in the city, like the kind of steps leading up and down to water bodies, like under bridges. And once we kind of became aware of that, we were able to find spraint much more easily and find their kind of active areas much more easily. And then I suppose that was when we started to find lots of spraints every week.
It's funny when you're walking around and you see lots of people sitting on the steps and things, you're like, they definitely don't know that they're probably sitting on otter spraint right now.
And what did you do with the spraints once you collected them and had them in the test tubes?
Once I had the spraints collected, I had a freezer, a special freezer in my kitchen that was dedicated just to holding otter spraints, and would bring the spraints back there and store them there. So yeah, it was just a big freezer beside my fridge, purely for otter sprains. You got a few funny looks at parties when people went to look for a beer or something like that, you know. Colin Lawton is a zoology lecturer in Ainoa, Galway. He's an expert in mammals and we've done lots of work on otters over the years. And he had one of his fourth year students, a woman by the name of Deirdre Clancy, do a project on the diet of otters in the city. So she was the main researcher who we gave the sprains to, who was studying them. And it's a tough project in a way, because you need to, you're basically identifying every fragment of bone and shell or whatever you find in the spraint, and trying to figure out what animal it's come from so that you can figure out what this particular otter has eaten.
My name is Deirdre Clancy, and I studied for a degree in marine science in NUIG. And the title of my thesis was a study of the diet of the Eurasian otter, Lutra lutra, in the waterways of Galway City. Irish Wildlife Trust were doing a survey, so just worked in my favour, really.
Yeah,
they had collected all the sprains. They were collecting for about 18 months, and they had a total of 83 sprains, which was quite good. So meant I could just get straight into the lab and start work on the cleaning the sprains and stuff.
So once you got the sprains and you had them in the lab, what was involved?
So they all had to be cleaned. And to clean them, I had to soak them in a solution of denture cleaner and water, which broke down all the mucus matrix from around them and just left the hard and digestible bits behind. And they all had to be dried then overnight, and I stored them in Petri dishes and labelled them until I was ready to look at them under the microscope. So then I separated all the hard parts and identified them using keys, and so mostly it was fish bones and scales, feathers, teeth, and sometimes fur from mammals and stuff.
And would it be quite a long process to do that? Would you be able to do them in one batch, or would you have to deal with one sprain at a time?
Sprain at a time. It took ages. There was hundreds of bones in each sample, and they were tiny, like tiny. You couldn't identify them with the naked eye. You had to use a microscope even to see a lot of them, you know.
Yeah.
I wanted to know, you know, if they ate specifically one thing, or if they would just, like, if they're known to be opportunistic, meaning they'd eat absolutely anything. But in fact, there was eel in 80% of the sprains I tested. And that in itself is an important thing, because eels are so threatened and endangered now. So it could have a big impact on the otters in the future. There was plastic found in over a quarter of the sprains. The canals and rivers in Galway are very polluted anyway with plastic. The plastic was probably in the fish, and then the otters ate the fish.
The project is pretty much finished now in terms of surveying. Surveying finished last year, and Deirdre has finished her project as well. So I guess we're just kind of finishing things up and gonna kind of launch the project soon. And I try and use it to make people aware again of the presence of otters in the city. And like, besides the actual results of the survey and the dietary study and all that, I would hope that if we get a bit of publicity for it, that making people more aware of otters in the city and of the parts of the city that they use would hopefully be something that's kept in mind in any future development or construction projects in the city, that hopefully we now have some solid kind of information that otters use lots of areas of the city, and because they're a protected species, that would need to be taken into account in any future development.
Thank you, Donal. And now we continue our mini-series on the shoulders of giants, in which Moonagoes Wild reporter and biologist Terry Flanagan highlights some of the wide-ranging research currently being carried out here in Ireland. It's estimated that we have about 7,000 full-time PhD students, with a further 1,000 doing master's degrees. No doubt each of them are standing on the shoulders of giants, using the understanding gained by major thinkers from the past to make intellectual progress into the future. The conservation of rare species comes with great challenges, and no more so than those associated with the efforts needed to save one of Ireland's rarest species, the great yellow bumblebee. Once widespread throughout the country, there now only remains a single population on the Mullet Peninsula in County Mayo. Niamh Phelan from UCD's School of Agriculture has been studying this bumblebee for some time now, and the aim of her project is to provide more detailed information on its ecology by identifying the habitat, land use and the flowering plant species which it favours.
So, Niamh, this is typical bumblebee country. Tell us, where are we, and paint a picture.
So we're in County Mayo in Tairmancara Reserve, that is managed by Birdwatch Ireland. So it's nice, open, extensive grassland with red clover, white clover, knapweed and birdswood trefoil.
People would say they're all weeds, that should be all cut down.
No, that's a food source for bumblebees.
OK, tell us a little bit about bumblebees, because people would mix them up with ordinary honeybees.
Yes, so we have one species of honeybee and then we have 21 species of bumblebee, and they're divided into true bumblebees and cuckoo bumblebees.
And what's the difference?
True bumblebees are the ones that do pollination, and cuckoo bumblebees actually take over true bumblebees' nests, like the cuckoo bird.
Right, so it's a kind of a parasite.
Yeah.
We're looking at that. You can certainly see a honeybee there, and there was one bumblebee, but he's since gone. But you're studying a particular bumblebee. Which one are you studying?
So I'm studying the great yellow bumblebee, or known as Bombus distingentus, mm-hmm. and it's only found up in Belmullet Peninsula.
It's the rarest bumblebee in Ireland?
Yeah, and also the rarest in Scotland as well. There's a couple of different theories on why the great yellow is so rare. The main one is the intensification of agriculture and the loss of flower-rich grasslands, and specifically around cutting for silage in June.
So this is why it's so important to leave the wildflowers, like we're seeing here, the clovers, the red clovers and the white clovers.
Exactly, yeah.
Was this bumblebee ever in any other parts of the country, in Dublin, anywhere like that?
Yeah, so it was kind of found in isolated patches throughout Ireland, and then it started to move westward and then move upwards, and now is only found on the Mullet.
And how long has that been happening for?
Since about the 1920s, when records really started on bumblebees.
And what can be done for them?
Really, what's great for bumblebees is providing areas that they can forage in, so having the wildflower areas for them.
Now, tell us a little bit about your thesis.
So my thesis is trying to identify the habitat and floral associations of the great yellow bumblebee in hopes to put in a conservation plan along with Mayo County Council and Belmullet Tidy Towns.
So you're moving between Dublin and Mayo all the time, is that right?
Yeah.
And it's a master's that you're working on?
Yeah.
And do you think you could kind of incorporate it into a PhD?
There's definitely potential there for a PhD, and I'm hoping to continue research into the future.
And what do you think, from a practical level, people can do?
Practical level is really let your areas grow wild, provide habitats for bumblebees. You can also try to build small little nesting sites for them as well. There's great videos on YouTube on how to do that.
Tell us a little bit about the bumblebee then. Its life cycle, for instance.
The life cycle of the great yellow isn't specifically known, but overall, bumblebees kind of emerge in May, June. Just the queen, and the queen will look for a nest. At that time, you'll see them flying really close to the ground, back and forth and back and forth, and they're trying to inspect nests.
Now, do they build a nest or take over a nest?
Build a nest.
And do they use the same nest year in, year out, or do they rebuild them?
No, they choose a new nest every year.
And where do they build?
So it'll depend on species. Some of them like nesting in underground. And for my bumblebee, what is known is that they like nesting in earthen walls, so stone walls that have been covered over in soil and vegetation.
And within the nest, how many would you get? Because I know, for instance, in a honeybee nest, you could have 50,000.
Yeah, so it'll depend again on species. It could be kind of 30 up to 60 to 80.
Right, tell us a little bit about your bumblebee.
My bumblebee is bright yellow with a black stripe across its back, and it has a characteristically low buzz compared to other bumblebees, so I actually hear it before you can see it sometimes. You can hear it coming.
And around here in this particular area, are there many of them? Are there many nests?
Yeah, there's a good few nests. So on average, over the summer, you'll see about 60.
Unlike birds, you can't go out and you can catch them and tag them. Well, how do you follow them, or how do you monitor them?
There's a bumblebee monitoring transect that you can do, which is once a month, and you walk 1 to 2 kilometre transect and you monitor all bumblebees along the transect, and you'd submit that data to the National Biodiversity Data Centre.
Can you identify which bumblebees are from which nest?
No, people have done it before, but it's kind of like tying a string onto a bumblebee. That's really the best method that we have at the moment.
And can you do that?
Not really.
Do they sting?
So females sting.
Are they prone to stinging? I know like wasps would be more prone to sting than a honeybee, for instance.
No, bumblebees are lovely little creatures. You'd really have to aggravate them.
And will they die when they sting you?
No.
They don't?
No.
It's not like the honeybee?
No, your parents lied to you.
And how did you become interested in the great yellow bumblebee?
So I did my undergrad in UCC in zoology, and there they have a module where they bring guest lecturers in for fourth years on a Friday, and one of the guest lecturers was Dr. Dara Stanley, who gave a lecture on bumblebees. And then when I came to UCD, she was here, and I just said thank you for having such a great lecture. I really enjoyed it, and we kind of got talking then, and she said she had a project up in Mayo on the great yellow.
And that's how it started.
Yeah.
And what can you tell me that you've found out so far?
The bee seems to be habitat-specific to species-rich grasslands and really associated with the red and white clover, bird's foot trefoil and common knapweed.
And what recommendations would you be making to, say, Mayo County Council?
It would be great to see kind of more wildflower areas planted, and also to the creation of habitats as well for the great yellow around the earthen walls that I mentioned, and building those.
It's a very distinctive bumblebee because it's pretty much all yellow with just one black band in it, whereas most of the bumblebees are black with yellow bands.
Yeah, so they're the more common bumblebees. But yeah, the great yellow is bright yellow, and it's much brighter compared to other yellows of bumblebees.
Yeah. Is there much chance then that they could recolonise other areas in the country, or would you be advising it?
That's one of the really great things about insects, is that once the habitat is there, their populations do explode quite quickly.
So they would probably move in without you having to do it or to help them?
Yeah, once the habitat is there. So we really need to learn how to manage agriculture and also manage biodiversity in kind of a sync. Surprisingly, it's getting more and more common for people to enjoy pollinators and monitor them. And I'm really starting to see now, after growing in the media, and it's really enthusiastic for researchers to see that, and people are positively responding to what we're doing. So because bumblebees are at the base of the food chain, they really have a knock-on effect for the rest of the food chain, insects in general, and grasslands and forage and vegetation.
It's been a really nice summer. It must have helped the bumblebees in general.
Yeah, so the more days that bumblebees can get out is really the more forage that they're able to collect, the more pollen that they're able to collect. So they're looking for nice, bright, sunny days.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been studying them all summer.
Yeah.
What's the most unusual thing you've found about them?
One of the quirkiest things I love to see is bumblebees disappearing in under the ground, and people actually don't realise that their nest is in under the ground.
So they just disappear? Gone.
Disappear into a kind of an old rabbit hole or...
What do your friends say when you say, I'm going away down to County Mayo for the summer?
They have nominated me as the crazy bumblebee lady, yes.
Now, I haven't actually seen one yet because they are quite rare. We might go and have a little ramble along. I'd love to see one because I've never seen one.
Yeah.
Might have a look for one, see if we can see one before we finish.
Okay, let's go.
Thank you, Terry. That's all we have time for today. More information on our website, rte.ie/Mooneymite. Thanks to all of our contributors today, our researcher John Riley and series producer Anna Leddy. Until next time, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.